The Teaching of the Master by Brother L.G. Sargent. Section 5, Living in God. Chapter 1, The Magnet of the Heart. Matthew 6, verse 19 to 23. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon the earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves dig through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not dig through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there also will your heart be. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. But if thine eye be evil, thy whole body will be dark. If therefore the light that is in thee be darkness, the darkness, how great it is! The underlying theme of Matthew chapter 6, verse 1 to 18, has been that the true and eternal reward can only come as the result of a life of communion with God. And this leads on to a new section in which the reward is contemplated as the true treasure of life. The two sections are joined in thought by several interwoven strands. In contrast with the true worship is hypocrisy, and in contrast with the true treasure is avarice. The two are so often found together that they may be reckoned as the twin spiritual perils of the pursuit of righteousness. And if the righteousness which many of the Pharisees showed was hollow, so were the riches in which they trusted. With a force which tends to be weakened in translation, Jesus says, "Treasure not up for yourselves treasure upon earth." Men think they make lasting provision when they lay by a store of valuable clothes, supplies of corn, or a hoard of money. But moth may destroy the fabrics, insects and rodents corrupt the grain and render it worthless, and thieves may burrow through the mud walls of the houses, dig through, the Revised Version margin has it, and steal the gold, perhaps killing the owner to escape detection. The saying covers all the forms in which wealth was customarily hoarded. Rust is literally eating, and more probably refers to devouring by vermin than to chemical changes in metal. James, however, in a passage obviously based on the Lord's saying, uses a word which specifically means metallic corrosion. This is James chapter 5, verse 2 to 3. Buried in the Lord's words is a double allusion to Isaiah, which calls for a further examination of some passages referred to in an earlier chapter. In a prophecy of the suffering servant, in Isaiah 50, verse 9, it is said, "Lo, they all shall wax old as a garment, the moth shall eat them up." In the following chapter, the faith of the servant is made a pattern for the people of God for whom he suffers, and his words are repeated in calling on them to look at the eternal realities in contrast to the heavens and the earth of a passing world order. And so the people in whose heart is God's law are adjured not to fear the reproach of men. For the moth shall eat them up like a garment, and the worm shall eat them like wool. But my righteousness shall be for ever, and my salvation unto all generations. When the allusion to those passages is recognized, the Lord's reference to everyday facts of decay and loss carries an overtone of meaning. The saying still declares plainly enough that earthly riches may perish, and only the treasures of the Spirit are unfading. But the spoiled grain and the moth-eating cloak are also pictorial emblems for something more. They are the symbols of a world in which men set their hearts, and those whose hearts are in the world are as doomed to perish as the world order to which they belong. They, like it, shall vanish like smoke. Behind the Lord's words is the same profound belief as in the prophet that enduring life can only be found in the eternal and victorious righteousness of God. Therefore, says Jesus, treasure up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Earth and heaven, as simple terms for place, give the saying poetic antithesis. But in Jewish usage, heaven is a reverential synonym for God, and in heaven is equivalent to with God. The Old Testament speaks of God as laying up a store for the righteous. If their desire is set on this divine treasure, then they indeed have treasure with God. But God may store judgment for the future as well as goodness, and a man's own life determines of which kind the store shall be. So men may be said to lay it up by their own action. Riches profit not in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivereth from death. For this reason James, in the passage quoted above, tells the godless rich, ye have laid up your treasure in the last days. James 5 verse 3, Revised Version. In heaping up earthly treasures by extortion and oppression, they have accumulated another store, the wrath that is reserved for them in the day of judgment. And James, with the proverb about the day of wrath in mind, is giving a pungent turn to the figures used by Jesus. It is another example of the rich elusiveness of Scripture, in which streams from two sources can merge in a single phrase. Paul also has his allusion to the Lord's words when he exhorts Timothy to charge them that are rich in this world not to have their hopes set on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, and that they be rich in good works, laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on the life which is life indeed. Not only does God lay up treasure for those who are God-fearing, but they are a treasure to him. They shall be mine, he says, in the day that I do make even a peculiar treasure. This is the kernel of Malachi's message, that the true Israel are they that fear the Lord, and who alone are written in his book of remembrance. And it deliberately recalls the use of the same expression at the beginning of Israel's national history. They are chosen as God's prized possession. But it is Abraham's seed of faith who are truly God's treasure. And so Peter writes to those sojourners of the dispersion, who are elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, through sanctification of the Spirit, unto obedience and sprinkling of the blood of Christ. And in the language of the law, and in the spirit of the prophet, he says, but ye are an elect race, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that ye should show forth the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvellous light. These are the Lord's inheritance, a term which is used of Israel of old. And Paul, applying the Old Testament language to the spiritual Israel, can write to the Ephesians of the riches of the glory of God's inheritance in the saints. But if they are the Lord's inheritance, he also is theirs. The Lord is the portion of mine inheritance and of my cup. Thou maintainest my lot. The lines are fallen unto me in pleasant places. Yea, I have a goodly heritage. Psalm 16, verses 5 to 6. The words are those of the Spirit of Christ in the Psalms. For what of true is him is also true of those who are in him. If they are the Lord's treasure, so he is theirs. And they can cry with Asaph, My flesh and my heart faileth. But God is the rock of my heart, and my portion for ever. In the light of these sayings of the psalmist, we can feel the force of the Lord's words. For where your treasure is, there also will be your heart. The heart will turn as surely as the needle of the compass towards what we really value. No amount of outward religious performance will change its direction for long if the world provides its pole. But if God is our prized possession, then to him our hearts will be drawn, and he is the only possession which can never perish, and can ensure that the possessors will never perish either. We cannot pretend that delight and a sense of wealth in God come easily to human nature. Only a long and constant direction of the mind can bring the consciousness of that precious treasure. Set your mind, says Paul, set it like a ship on a course, on the things that are above, not on the things that are on the earth, for ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. Life is our treasure, and our treasure, like our citizenship, is in heaven. Christ, too, had his treasure, which God had laid up for him from the beginning of the ages, for he could pray to the Father, Glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was. A share in his glory will be the lot of those who are meet to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in light, for whom the hope is laid up in the heavens. For Christ in them is the hope of glory. The eye is the light giver of the body. Unless light can penetrate it, all is dark within, however bright the sunlight around. And so, by a kind of metonymy, Jesus calls it the lamp. The world is light for a man with a clear eye, and he himself is, as it were, filled with light. So it is in the things of the Spirit. The sunlight of God's truth shines around, but can it enter the man? If it cannot, nothing irradiates the darkness of his own nature. And if that which ought to convey light is darkened, that which is by nature dark must be dark indeed. What can darken the eye so that it fails of its function? The clue is in the context. Jesus has been talking of the treasure on which men's heart is set, and in Jewish usage the single and evil eye have particular meanings which go back to the Old Testament. When a poor Israelite wanted to borrow, Beware, says Moses to the potential lender, lest there be a base thought in thine heart, saying, The seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and thine eye be evil toward thy brother, and thou give him nought. The evil eye was blind to the other's need, and saw only the chances of gain or loss. But when famine came in the siege as one of the punishments on disobedient Israel, a man might look on his closest kin with an eye even more perverted. He might be driven to a dreadful greed. His eye shall be evil towards his brother, so that he shall not give any of them of the flesh of his children whom he shall eat. desire for possession is the motive which corrupts the eye. He that hath an evil eye hasteth after riches. Greed leads to envy, and envy to treachery. Eat not the bread of him that hath an evil eye, for as he reckoneth within himself, so is he. Eat and drink, saith he to thee, but his heart is not with thee. On the other hand, he that hath a bountiful margin good eye shall be blessed, for he giveth of his bread to the poor. In the New Testament, an evil eye is one of the defilements coming from within, out of the heart of man. And when the householder in the parable rebukes the labourers who grudge the late comers equal pay, he says, "Is thine eye evil, because I am good? Are they greedy and envious, because he is generous?" The evil eye results from an attachment to earthly treasure, which corrupts the spirit and blinds the heart. The good or single eye, on the other hand, is that of the liberal man, whose vision is unclouded by greed, and his mind not divided by envy. And so singleness becomes a New Testament term, and especially a Pauline term, for liberality. In Luke 11, verses 33 to 36, a familiar saying is found in the discourse which follows the Lord's refusal to give a sign other than the sign of the prophet Jonah. "The generation who sought a sign when they had him in their midst were condemned by the example of the Ninevites and the Queen of Sheba. If they had not been blind, they would have no need to make the request. If they could not see the living sign, it was because they themselves were full of darkness, and the organ which should let light into them was diseased." In this context, single and evil must have a wider meaning. They were blinded by jealousy rather than by a niggardly spirit. But in Matthew, the words form a bridge between the saying about treasure and the warning against mammon.